From PRI, Public Radio International.
Daniel played standards with the old guys. One night, some white boys from a fraternity yelled forward to the stage at the black man holding the acoustic guitar and began to shout, "Play Dixie for us! Play Dixie for us!" Daniel gave them a long look, studied their big tooth grins and their beer shiny eyes stuck into puffy pale faces, hovering over golf shirts and chinos. He looked from them to the uncomfortable expressions on the faces of the old guys with whom he was playing, and then to the embarrassed faces of the other college kids in the club. And then he started to play.
You're listening to Reuben Santiago Hudson reading from Percival Everett's The Appropriation of Cultures, which we'll hear in its entirety later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. On the notes for this recording session, my colleague, the Selected Shorts producer, Catherine Minton, scrawled next to the titles of the two stories you'll hear on this broadcast the phrase, "Passions Run Deep." And Kathy is right. In each of these two very American stories, different as they may be from each other, one harrowing and the other hilarious, a fervent belief drives the narrative along. The first tale we'll hear is from an annual evening devoted to the Houghton Mifflin volume Best American Short Stories 2008, edited by Salman Rushdie. It's by a great friend of Selected Shorts, the wonderful author Tobias Wolfe, and it's called Bible. It takes a little while for the real purpose of the angry man in the story to become clear, and you may be as surprised as the woman in the story is to discover what that is. Jane Alexander, whose experience has ranged from Broadway to Hollywood to running the National Endowment for the Arts for a spell, is our reader. Bible by Tobias Wolfe.
It was dark when Maureen left the 100 Club. She stopped just outside the door, a little thrown by the sudden cold, the change from daylight to night. A gusting breeze chilled her face. Lights burned over the storefronts, gleaming in patches of ice along the sidewalk. She reached in her pockets for her gloves, then hopelessly searched her purse. She'd left them in the club. If she went back for them, she knew she'd end up staying, and so much for all her good intentions. Teresa or one of the others would pick up the gloves and bring them to school on Monday. Still, she stood there. Someone came out the door behind her, and Maureen heard music and voices raised over the music. Then the door swung shut, and she tightened her scarf and turned down the sidewalk toward the lot where she'd left her car. She had gone almost a block when she realized that she was walking in the wrong direction. Easy mistake. The lot where she and the others usually park had been full. She headed back, crossing the street to avoid the club. Her fingers had gone stiff. She put her hands in her coat pockets, but then yanked them out when her right foot took a skid on the ice. After that, she kept them poised at her sides. Head bent, she shuffled in tender steps from one safe spot to the next, for all the world like her own worn-out, balding, arthritic mother. Maureen allowed herself this thought in self-mockery to make herself feel young, but it did not have that effect. The lot was farther than she'd been aware of as she strolled to the club with Molly and Jane and Evan. Evan laughing at Evan's story about his manic Swedish girlfriend. She'd had an awful day at school and was happy to let the week go, to lose herself in jokes and gossip and feel the pale late sunshine almost warm on her face. Now her face was numb and she was tense with the care of simply walking. She passed a hunched, foot-stamping crowd waiting to get into Harrigan's, where she herself had once gone to hear the local bands. It had been called Far Horizon then, or Lost Horizon, that was it. She scanned the faces as she walked by, helplessly on the watch for her daughter. She hadn't seen her in almost 2 years now, since Grace walked away from a full scholarship at Ithaca College to come back and live with one of Maureen's fellow English teachers from St. Ignatius. It turned out they'd been going at it since Grace's senior year at SI, and him a married man with a young daughter. Maureen had always tried to see Grace's willfulness as backbone, but this she could not accept. She had said some unforgivable things, according to Grace. Since when, Maureen wanted to know, had a few home truths been unforgivable? She was still trying to bring Grace around when Father Crespi got wind of the whole business and fired the teacher. Maureen had not been Father Crespi's source, but Grace wouldn't believe it. She declared things at an end between them, and so far she had kept that vow, though she dumped the luckless fool within a few weeks of his leaving his wife. Grace was still close to Maureen's mother. From her, Maureen had learned that Grace was doing temp work and keeping house with another man. Maureen couldn't get her mother to say more. She'd given her word. But the old bird clearly enjoyed not saying more, being in the know, being part of Maureen's punishment for driving Grace away, as she judged the matter. Maureen crossed the street again and turned into the parking lot, an unpaved corner tract surrounded by a chain-link fence. The attendance shack was dark. She picked her way over ridges of frozen mud toward her car. Last summer's special offer paint job was already dull, bleached out by road salt. Through a scrim of dried slush on the window, Maureen could see the stack of student blue books on the passenger seat, a weekend's worth of grading. She fished the keys from her purse, but her hand was dead with cold, and she fumbled them when she tried to unlock the door. They hit the ground with a merry tinkle. She flexed her fingers and bent down for the keys. As she pushed herself back up, a pain shot through her bad knee. "God," she said, "don't curse." The voice came from behind Maureen, a man's voice, but high, almost shrill. She closed her eyes. He said something she couldn't make out. He had some sort of accent. He said it again, then added, "Now." "What?" "The keys. Give them to me." Maureen held the keys out behind her, eyes pressed shut. She had just one thought: don't see him. The keys were taken from her hand, and she heard the door being unlocked. "Open it," the man said. "Open the door." "Yes, now get in." "Just take it," Maureen said. "Please. Please, you will get in. Please." He took her arm and half pushed, half lifted her into the car and slammed the door shut. She sat behind the steering wheel with her head bent, eyes closed, hands folded over her purse. The passenger door opened. "Compositions," the man muttered. "Exams," she said, and cringed at the stupidity in correcting him. Maureen heard the blue books thud onto the floor and back. Then he was on the seat beside her. He sat there a moment, breathing quick, shallow breaths. "Open your eyes. Open. Yes, now, drive." He jingled the keys. Looking straight ahead over the wheel, she said, "I don't think I can." She sensed a movement toward her and flinched. He jingled the keys beside her and dropped them in her lap. "Drive." Maureen had once taken a class in self-defense. That was 5 years ago, after her marriage ended and left her alone with a teenage daughter, as if the dangers outside somewhere and not already in the house between them were great. She'd forgotten all the fancy moves, but not her determination to fight, for Grace or for herself, to go on the attack, kick the bastard in the balls, scream and kick and hit and bite, fight to the very death. She hadn't forgotten any of this, even now, watching herself do nothing. She was aware of what she was failing to do, was unable to do, and the shock of understanding that she could not depend on herself produced a sense of resignation, an empty, echoing calm. With steady hands, she started the car and pulled out of the lot and turned left as the man directed away from the lights of the commercial zone toward the river.
"Not so slow," he said. She sped up. "Slower."
She slowed down.
"You are trying to be arrested," he said.
"No." He made a mirthless laughing sound.
"Oh, do I look like a fool?"
"No, I don't know. I haven't seen you."
"I am not a fool. Turn right."
They were on Frontage Road now, heading upriver. The night was clear, and the almost full moon hung just above the old tanneries on the far bank. The moon made a broad silver path on the smooth water in the middle of the river, glimmered dully on the slabs of ice jammed up along the sides. The moonlight on Marine's bare hands turned them ghostly white on the steering wheel. They looked cold. They were cold. She felt chilled through. She turned up the heater, and within moments, the car was filled with a man's smell. Ripe, loamy, not unpleasant.
"You are using alcohol," the man said.
She waited for him to say more. His knees were angled toward her, pressed together against the console. "A little," she said. He was silent. His breathing slowed, deepened, and Maureen felt obscurely grateful for this. She could feel him watching her. "Over $70 is in my purse," she said. "Please, just take it."
$70? That is your offer?
He laughed the unreal laugh. "I can get more," she said. Her voice was small and flat, not her voice at all. She hesitated, then said, "We'll have to go to an ATM.
"This is not about money. Drive, please."
And so she did. This was something she could do, drive a car on Frontage Road as she had done for almost 30 years now. She drove past the Toll House Inn, past the bankrupt development with its unfinished skeletal houses open to the weather, past the road to the bridge that would take her home, past the burned-out house with the trailer beside it, on past the brickworks and the quarry and a line of dairy farms and the farm her grandparents had worked as tenants to escape the tannery, where, after several years of learning the hard way, the owner sold out, and a new owner found more experienced hands and sent them packing. When she was young, Maureen and her sisters had picked strawberries with their mother on different farms, and Maureen had marveled at how her mother could chat with a woman in the next row or just look dully into the distance while her fingers briskly ransacked the plants for ripe berries as if possessed of their own eyes and purpose. At the end of the day, she'd look over Maureen's card, punched for a fraction of the flats she herself had picked, then hand it back and say, "At least that mouth of yours works." Maureen drove on past the harshly lit 7-Eleven and the Christmas tree farm and the old ferry pier where she and Francis, her ex-husband, then a sweet, shy boy, had parked after high school dances to drink and make out. On through pale fields and brief stands of bare black trees that in summer made a green roof overhead. She knew every rise and turn, and the car took them easily, and Maureen surrendered to the comfort of her mastery of the road. The silent man beside her seemed to feel it too. It seemed to be holding him in a trance. Then he shifted, leaned forward.
"Turn right up here," he said in a low voice, "on that road. You see that one up there after the sign?
Maureen made the turn almost languidly. The side road was unplowed, covered with crusty snow that scraped against the undercarriage of the car. She hit a deep dip. The front end clanged. The wheel spun wild for a moment. Then they caught, and the car shot forward again, headlights jumping giddily. The road bent and ended in a clearing surrounded by tall pines.
You drive too fast, the man said.
She waited, engine running, hands still on the wheel, headlights ablaze on a park service sign, picturing animals and plants to be seen hereabouts. The peaked roof over the sign wore a hat of snow. It came to Maureen that she'd been to this place before, a trailhead, unfamiliar at first in its winter bleakness. She'd come here with Grace's scout troop to hike up to the palisades overlooking the river. The trail was historic, a route of attack for some battle in the Revolutionary War. The man sniffed again.
Beer, he said.
I was having a drink with friends.
A drink? You stink of it. That great lady teacher.
That he knew she was a teacher, that he knew anything about her, snapped the almost serene numbness that had overtaken Maureen. She thought of his seeing the essays. That could explain his knowledge of her work, but not his tone, the personal scorn and triumph in his discovery of her weakness as he clearly saw it. A small, dull pain pulsed behind her eyes, all that was left of the drink she'd had. The heat blowing in the car was making her contacts dry and scratchy. She reached over to turn it down, but he seized her wrist and pulled it back. His fingers were thin and damp. He turned the heat up again.
Leave it like this. Warm, he said, and dropped her hand.
She almost looked at him then, but stopped herself. Please, she said, what do you want?
This is not about sex, he said. That is what you are thinking, of course. That is what the American answer to everything.
Maureen looked ahead and said nothing. She could see the lights of cars on Frontage Road flickering between the tree trunks. She wasn't very far from the road, but the idea of running for it appeared to her a demeaning absurdity, herself flailing through the drifts like some weeping, dopey, sacrificial extra in a horror movie.
You know nothing about our life, he said, who we are, what we have had to do in this country. I was a doctor, but okay, so they won't let me be a doctor here. I give that up. I give up the old life so my family will have a new one. My son will be a doctor, not me. Okay, I accept that's how it is.
Where are you from? Maureen asked and then said, never mind, hoping he wouldn't answer. It seemed to her that the loamy smell was stronger, more sour. She kept her eyes on the park service sign and the headlights, but she was aware of the man's knees knocking rapidly and soundlessly together.
Never mind, he said. Yes, that is exactly your way of thinking. That is exactly how the great lady teacher destroys a family, without a thought. Never mind.
But I don't know your family. She waited. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, you don't know what I'm talking about. You have already forgotten. Never mind.
You have the wrong person, Maureen said.
Have you told a lie, lady teacher?
Please, you must have the wrong person. What you're saying, none of it makes sense. And because this was certainly true, because nothing he'd said had anything to do with her, Maureen felt compelled, as a prelude to a serious sorting out of this whole mess, to turn and look at him. He was leaning back into the corner, hunched into a puffy coat of the vivid orange color worn by highway crews. In the reflected glare of the headlights, his dark eyes had a blurred, liquid brightness. Above the straight line of his eyebrows, the bald dome of his head gleamed dully. He wore a short beard. A few thin patches of it grew high on his cheeks, to just below his eyes.
"I have the right person," he said. "Now will you please answer me?"
She was confused. She shook her head as if to clear it.
"No," he said. "The great lady teacher has never told a lie."
"What are you talking about? What lie?" A sudden glint of teeth behind the beard.
"You tell me."
"Any lie? Ever?"
"Ever. Any lie or cheat."
"This is ridiculous. Of course I have. Who hasn't, for God's sake?" He rocked forward and jabbed his head at her.
"Don't curse! No more cursing!"
Maureen could see his face clearly now. The full, finely molded, almost feminine lips, the long, thin nose, the dark, unexpected freckles across the bridge of his nose and under his eyes, vanishing into the beard. She turned away and leaned her throbbing head against the steering wheel.
"You can lie and cheat," he said. "That's okay, no problem. Who hasn't? Never mind. But for others, poof! No faults allowed."
"This is crazy," she murmured.
"No, Mrs. Casey. What is crazy is to destroy a good boy's life for nothing."
Her breath caught. She raised her head and looked at him.
"Hassan makes one mistake. One mistake, and you destroy him," he said. "Understand this, most esteemed lady teacher. I will not allow it."
"Hassan? Hassan is your son?" He leaned back again, lips pursed, cheeks working out and back like a fish's. Hassan. She liked him. Too much. He was tall and graceful and broodingly, soulfully handsome. Not very bright, Hassan. And bone idle, but with a sudden offhand charm that amused her and had distracted her from dealing firmly with him, as he well knew. He'd been getting away with murder all year, fudging on his homework, handing in essays he obviously hadn't written, and Maureen had done nothing but warn him. She hated calling people on their offenses. Her own raised voice and shaking hands, her heart pumping out righteousness, all the rituals of grievance and reproach were distasteful to her and had always held her back up to a point. Beyond that point, she did not spare the lash, but she was slow to get there. Her sisters had pushed her around. She'd spoiled her daughter. Her husband's gambling had brought them to the point of ruin before her cowardice became too shameful to bear, and she began to challenge his excuses and evasions and finally faced him down, ran him off, as Grace liked to say when she wanted to cut deep. A similar self-disgust had caught up with Maureen this morning. After months of letting Hassan slide, she'd seen him blatantly cheating during an exam, and she'd blown, really blown, surprising even herself. She'd pulled him out of class and told him in some detail how little she thought of him, then sent him home with a promise, shouted at his back, to report his cheating to Father Crespi, who would certainly expel him. Hassan had turned then and said evenly,
"Stupid cow."
And now, remembering that betrayal, the advantage he'd taken, his insulting confidence that he could cheat in front of her with impunity, she felt her fingers tighten on the steering wheel, and she stared fixedly in front of her, seeing nothing. "Hassan," she said.
"I will not allow it," he repeated.
"Hassan has been cheating all year," she said. "I warned him this was the last straw."
Warnings. You should have given him help, not warnings. It's hard for Hassan. He wasn't born here. His English is not good. Hassan's English is fine. He's lazy and dishonest. That's his problem. He'd rather cheat than do the work. Hassan is going to be a doctor. Sure. He will be a doctor. He will, and you won't stop him. You, a drunken woman. Oh, she said, of course. Of course, women, all our fault, right? Bunch of stupid cows messing things up for the bulls. No, I bow before woman. Woman is the hand, the heart, the soul of her home, set there by God himself. All comes from her. All is owed to her. Now you're quoting, Marine said. Who's your source? The home, he said. Not the army, not the surgery, not the judge's chair giving laws, not the discotheque. Who's your source? Marine repeated. God, is it? The man drew back. Have some care, he said. God is not mocked. Marine rubbed her scratchy eyes and one of her contacts drifted out of focus. She blinked furiously until it slipped back into place. I'm turning the heat off, she said. No, leave it warm. But she turned it off anyway, and he made no move to stop her. He looked wary, watching her from his place against the door. He looked cornered, as if she had seized him and forced him to this lonely place. The car engine was doing something strange, surging, then almost dying, then surging again. The noise of the blower had masked it. Piece of shit. Another paycheck down the drain. Okay, doctor, she said. You've got your parent-teacher conference. What do you want? You will not report Hassan to Mr. Crespi. Father Crespi, you mean. I call no man father but one. Wonderful. So you choose a school called St. Ignatius. I understand. This would not happen if Hassan were Catholic. Oh, please. Hassan can't speak English. Hassan needs help. Hassan isn't Catholic. Jesus, I'm not even Catholic. He made his laughing sound. Oh, so you choose a school called St. Ignatius. With your Jesus on the cross behind your desk. I have seen it myself at the open house. I was there. I was there. But no, she is not Catholic. Not this Maureen Casey. Even with the heat off, the air in the car was stale and close. Maureen opened her window halfway and leaned back, bathing her face in the cold draft of air. That's right, she said. I've had it with clueless men passing on orders from God. Without God, there is no foundation, he said. Without God, we stand on nothing. Anyway, you're too late. I've already reported him. You have not. Mr. Crespi is out of town until Monday. Father Crespi. Well, I'm impressed. At least you've done your homework. Hassan is going to be a doctor, he said, rubbing his hands together, gazing down at them as if expecting some visible result. Look at me. Look at me. Now listen. She held the man's liquid eyes, held the moment, not at all displeased with what she was about to say, though true, would give him pain. Hassan is not going to be a doctor, she said. Wait, just listen. Honestly now, can you picture Hassan in medical school? Even supposing he could get in, even supposing he can get through college at all. Think about it. Hassan in medical school. What an idea.
You could make a comedy. Hassan goes to medical school. No, Hassan will not be a doctor. And you know it. You've always known it. She gave that thought some room to breathe. Then she said, "So, it doesn't really matter if I report him or not, does it?" Still, she held his eyes. His lips were working. He seemed about to say something, but no sound emerged. She said, "So, let's say I don't play along. Let's say I'm going to report him, which I am. What are you going to do about it? I mean, what were you thinking tonight?" He looked away, back down at his hands. "You followed me from school, right? You waited for me. You had this spot picked out. What are you going to do if I didn't play along?" He shook his head. "Well, what? Kill me?" He didn't answer. "You were going to kill me? Too much. Have you got a gun?" "No. I own no guns. A knife? No." "What then?" Head bent, he resumed rubbing his hands together as if over a fire. "Stop that. What then?" He took a deep breath. "Please," he said. "Strangle me? With those? Stop that." She reached over and seized his wrists. They were thin, bony. "Hey," she said. Then again, "Hey." When at last he raised his eyes to her, she lifted his hands and pressed the palms to her neck. They were cold, colder than the air on her face. She dropped her own hands. "Go on," she said. She felt his fingers icy against her neck. His eyes, dark and sad, searched hers. "Go on," she said softly. The engine surged, and he blinked as if in surprise and pulled his hands away. He rested them in his lap, looked at them unhappily, then put them between his knees. "No," she said. "Mrs. Casey." She waited, but that was all he said. "Tell me something," she said. "What did your wife think of this brainstorm? Did you tell her?"
"My wife is dead."
"I didn't know that," he shrugged. "I'm sorry."
"Mrs. Casey."
Again she waited, then said, "What?"
"The window. It is very cold."
Maureen had a mind to say no to him, let him freeze, but she was getting pretty numb herself. She rolled the window up.
"And please, the heater."
Maureen drove back down Frontage Road. He kept his face to the other window, his back to her. Now and then she saw his shoulders moving, but he didn't make a sound. She had planned to put him out by the turnoff for her bridge, let him find his own way from there. But as she approached the exit, she couldn't help asking where he'd left his car. He said it was in the same lot where she'd parked hers. Ah, yes, that made sense. She drove on. They didn't speak again until she had stopped just up from the parking lot under a streetlight in plain view of the drunks walking past. Even here, cocooned in the car, engine surging, Maureen could feel the heavy bass thump of the music coming from Harrigan's.
"Hassan will be dismissed from school?"
"Probably." "He's spoiled. It'll do him good in the long run." "You're the one I haven't made my mind up about. You're the one on the hot seat, do you understand?" He bowed his head. "I don't think you do. Forget the prison time you're looking at. You haven't even said you're sorry." "I said it about your wife, which makes me the only one who's used that word tonight, which strikes me as pretty..."
ridiculous given the circumstances. But I am sorry. Yeah, we'll see. One thing, though. Suppose I'd promised not to report Hassan. Whatever made you think I'd keep my word? He reached into the breast pocket of his coat and took out a white book and laid it on the dashboard. Maureen picked it up. It was a Bible, a girl's Bible, bound in imitation leather with gilt lettering on the cover, the pages edged in gilt. You would swear, he said, like in court, to the judge. Maureen opened it, riffled the thin, filmy pages. Where did you get this? Goodwill. My dear, she said, you really thought you could save him. He pushed the door open. I am sorry, Mrs. Casey. Here. Maureen held out the Bible, but he put up the palms of his hands and backed out of the car. She watched him make his way down the street, a short man, hatless, his bright, puffy coat billowing with the gusts. She saw him turn into the parking lot, but forgot to observe his leaving, as she'd intended, because she got caught up leafing through the Bible. Her father had given her one just like it after her confirmation. She still kept it on her bedside table. This Bible had belonged to Clara Gutierrez. Below her name, someone had written an inscription in Spanish. Maureen couldn't make it out in the dim light, only the day, large and underlined, Pascua, 1980. Where was she now, this Clara? What had become of her? This ardent, hopeful girl in her white dress, surrounded by her family, godparents, friends, that her Bible should end up in a goodwill bin. Even if she no longer read it or believed it, she wouldn't have thrown it away, would she? Had something happened? Ah, girl, where were you?
That was Jane Alexander, who read Tobias Wolff's short story, Bible. After a short break, we'll be back with an amazing story read by Ruben Santiago Hudson. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. In our next story, once again, passions and prejudices, especially the latter, certainly do run deep. But we learn that there is an amazing way in which these can be overcome. This story, Percival Everett's The Appropriation of Cultures, is one of my all-time favorites and is a crowd-pleaser at live readings, as listeners howl at the revelation of the hero's outrageous strategy. Percival Everett is the author of 16 novels, 3 collections of short fiction, and 2 volumes of poetry. The reader is the Broadway actor, Tony winner, and director, Ruben Santiago Hudson. The Appropriation of Cultures.
Daniel Barclay had money left to him by his mother. He had a house, which had been left to him by his mother. He had a degree in American Studies from Brown University, which he had in some way earned, but had not yet earned anything for him. He played a 1940 Martin guitar with a Barkus Berry pickup and drove a 1976 Jensen Interceptor, which he had purchased after his mother's sister had died and left him her money, she having had no children of her own. Daniel Barkley didn't work and didn't pretend to need to, spending most of his time reading. Some nights he went to a joint near the campus of the University of South Carolina and played jazz with some old guys who all worked very hard during the day but didn't hold Daniel's condition against him. Daniel played standards with the old guys, but what he loved to play was old-time slide tunes. One night, some white boys from a fraternity yelled forward to the stage at the black man holding the acoustic guitar and began to shout, "Play Dixie for us! Play Dixie for us!" Daniel gave them a long look, studied their big tooth grins and their beer shiny eyes stuck into puffy pale faces, hovering over golf shirts and chinos. He looked from them to the uncomfortable expressions on the faces of the old guys with whom he was playing, and then to the embarrassed faces of the other college kids in the club. And then he started to play. He felt his way slowly through the chords of the song once and listened to the deadened hush as it fell over the room. He used the slide to squeeze out the melody of the song he had grown up hating, the song the whites had always pulled out to remind themselves and those other people just where they were. Daniel sang the song. He sang it slowly. He sang it, feeling the lyrics, deciding that the lyrics were his, deciding that the song was his. Old times there are not forgotten. He sang the song and listened to the silence around him. He resisted the urge to let satire ring through his voice. He meant what he sang. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. When he was finished, he looked up to see the room full of eyes on him. One person clapped, then another. And soon the tavern was filled with applause and hoots. He found the frat boys in the back and watched as they stormed out, a couple of people near the door chuckling at them as they passed. Roger, the old guy who played tenor sax, slapped Daniel on the back and said something like, "Right on," or "Cool." Roger then played the first few notes of "Take the A-Train," and they were off. When the set was done, all the college kids slapped Daniel on the back as he walked toward the bar where he found a beer waiting. Daniel didn't much care for the slaps on the back, but he didn't focus too much energy on that. He was busy trying to sort out his feelings about what he had just played. The irony of his playing the song straight and from the heart was made more ironic by the fact that as he played it, it came straight and from his heart. As he was claiming Southern soil, or at least recognizing his blood in it, his was the land of cotton, and hell no, it was not forgotten. At 23, his anger was fresh and typical, and so was his ease with it, the way it could be forgotten for chunks of time until something like that night with the white frat boys or simply a flashing blue light in the rearview mirror brought it all back. He liked the song, wanted to play it again, knew that he would. He drove home from the bar on Green Street and back to his house where he made tea and read about Pickett's charge at Gettysburg while he sat in the big leather chair which had been his father's. He fell asleep and had a dream in which he stopped Pickett's men on the Emmitsburg Road on their way to the field and said, "Give me back my flag." Daniel's friend Sarah was a very large woman with a very large Afro hairdo. And they were sitting on the porch of Daniel's having tea. The late fall afternoon was mild and slightly overcast. Daniel sat in the wicker rocker while Sarah curled her feet under her on the glider. "I wish I could have heard it," Sarah said. "Yeah, me too. Personally, I can't even stand to go in that place, all that drinking. Those white kids love to drink." Sarah studied her fingernails. "I guess the place is harmless. They seem to like the music. You think I should paint my nails?" Daniel frowned at her. "If you want to. I mean, really paint them. You know, black or with red, white, and blue stripes, something like that." And she held her hand, appearing to imagine the colors. "I'd have to grow them long." "What are you talking about? Just bullshitting." Daniel and Sarah went to a grocery market to buy food for lunch and Daniel's dinner. And Daniel pushed the cart through the Piggly Wiggly while Sarah walked ahead of him, and he watched her large movements and her confident stride. At the checkout, he added a bulletin full of pictures of local cars and trucks for sale to his items on the conveyor. "What's that for?" Sarah asked. "I think I want to buy a truck." "Buy a truck?" "Yeah, so I can drive you around when you paint your nails." Later, after lunch, and after Sarah had left him alone, Daniel sat in his living room and picked up the car sale magazine. As he suspected, there were several trucks he liked, and one in particular, a 1968 Ford 3/4 ton, with the one thing it shared with the other possibilities: a full rear cab window decal of the Confederate flag. He called the number the following morning, and he arranged with Barb, Travis's wife, to stop by and see the truck. Travis and Barb lived across the river in the town of Irmo, a name which Daniel had always thought suited a disease for cattle. He drove around the maze of tract homes until he found the right street and number. A woman in a housecoat across the street watched from her porch, safe inside the chain-link fence around her yard. From down the street, a man and a teenager who were covered with grease and apparently engaged in work on a torn-apart Dodge Charger mindlessly wiped their hands and studied him. Daniel walked across the front yard through a maze of plastic toys and knocked on the front door. Travis opened the door and asked in a surly voice, "What is it?" "I called about the truck," Daniel said. "Oh, you Dan?" Daniel nodded. "The truck in the backyard. Let me get the key." He pushed the door to, but it didn't catch. Daniel heard the quality of the exchange between Travis and Barb, but not the words. He did hear Barb say, as Travis pulled open the door, "I couldn't tell over the phone." "Got him," Travis said. "Come on with me." He looked at Daniel's Jensen as they walked through the yard. "What kind of car is that?" "It's a Jensen." "Nice looking. Is it fair?" "I guess." The truck looked a little rough, a pale blue with a bleached out hood and a crack across the top of the windshield. Travis opened the driver's side door and pushed the key in the ignition. "It's a strong runner," he said. Daniel put his hand on the faded hood and felt the warmth, knew that Travis had already warmed up the motor. Travis turned the key, and the engine just kicked over. He nodded to Daniel. Daniel nodded back. He looked up to see a blonde woman looking on from behind the screen door of the back porch. "The clutch and alternator are new this year." Travis stepped backward to the wall of the bed, and he looked in. "There's some rust back here, but the bottom's pretty solid." Daniel attended to the sound of the engine. "Misses just a little," he said. "Oh, a tune-up fixed that." Daniel regarded the rebel flag decal covering the rear window of the cab. He touched it with his finger. "Oh, that thing peeled right off," Travis said. "No, I like it." Daniel sat down in the trunk behind the steering wheel. "You mind if I take it for a spin?" "Sure thing." Travis looked toward the house, then back to Daniel. The brakes are good, but you got to press hard." Daniel nodded. Travis shut the door, his long fingers wrapped over the edge of the half-lowered glass. Daniel noticed that one of the man's fingernails was blackened. "I'll just take it around a block or two." The blonde woman was now standing outside the door on the concrete steps. Daniel put the truck in gear, and he drove out of the yard, past his car and down the street by the man and the teenager who was still at work on the Charger. They stared at him, were still watching him as he turned right at the corner. The truck handled decently, but that really wasn't important. Back at Travis's house, Daniel left the keys in the truck and he got out to observe the bald tires while Travis looked on. The ad in the magazine said 2,000. "Yeah, but I'm willing to work with you. Tell you what, I'll give you 2,200 if you deliver it to my house." Travis was lost, scratching his head and looking back at the house for his wife, who was no longer standing there. "Where about do you live?" "I live over near the university, near Five Points." "2,200? Travis said more to himself than to Daniel. "Sure, I can get it to your house." "Here's 200. Daniel counted out the money and handed it to the man. "I'll have the rest for you in cash when you deliver the truck." And he watched Travis feel the bills with his skinny fingers. "Can you have it there by 4?
"Yeah, I can do that."
What in the world do you need a truck for? Sarah asked. She stepped over to the counter and she poured herself another cup of coffee. And then she sat back down at the table with Daniel. I'm not buying the truck. Well, I am buying the truck, but only because I need the truck for the decal. I'm buying the decal. Decal? Yes, the truck has a Confederate flag in the back window. What? I've decided that the rebel flag is my flag. My blood is Southern blood, right? Well, it's my flag. Sarah put down her cup and saucer, and she picked up a cookie from the plate in the middle of the table. You have flipped. I knew this would happen to you if you didn't work. See, a person need to work. See, I don't need money. That's not the point. You don't have to work for money. And she stood and she walked to the edge of the porch and she looked up and down the street. Well, I got my books and my music. No, you need a job so you can be around people that you don't care about, doing stuff that you don't care about. You need a job to occupy that part of your brain. See, I suppose it's too late now, though. Nonetheless, Daniel said, you should have seen those redneck boys when I took Dixie from them. They didn't know what to do. So the goddamn flag is flying over the state capitals. Don't take it down. Just take it. That's what I say. That's all you had to do? That's all there is to it? Yep. Daniel leaned back in his rocker. You watch old Travis when he gets here. Travis arrived with the pickup a little bit before 4. His wife pulling up behind him in a yellow Trans Am. Barb got out of the car, walked up to the porch with Travis, and she gave the house a careful look. Hey, Travis, Daniel said. This is my friend, Sarah. Travis nodded hello. You must be Barb, Daniel said. Barb smiled weakly. Travis looked at Sarah, then back at the truck, and then at Daniel. You sure you don't want me to peel that thing out the window? I'm positive. Okay. Daniel gave Sarah a glance to be sure that she was watching Travis's face. Here's the balance, he said, handing over the money. He took the truck keys from the skinny fingers. Barb sighed and asked, as if the question was burning right through her, why you want that flag on truck? Well, why shouldn't I want it, Daniel asked. Barb didn't know what to say. She studied her feet for a second and then regarded the house again. I mean, you live in a nice house and drive that sports car. What you need a truck like that for? You don't want the money? Oh, yeah, we want the money, Travis said, trying to silence Barb with a look. Well, I need the truck for hauling stuff, Daniel said. You know, like groceries, and he looked to Sarah for help. Books, Sarah said, books. Things like that. Daniel held Barb's eyes until she looked away. He watched Travis sign his name to the back of the title and hand it to him, and as he took it, he said, I was just lucky enough to find a truck with the Black Power flag already on it. What? Travis screwed up his face trying to understand. The Black Power flag on the window. You mean you didn't know? Travis and Barb looked at each other. Well, anyway, Daniel said, I'm glad we could do business. He turned to Sarah. Let me take you for a ride in my new truck. He and Sarah walked across the yard, got into the pickup, and waved to Travis and Barb, who were still standing in Daniel's yard as they drove away. Sarah was on the verge of hysterics by the time they were out of sight. That was beautiful, she said. No, Daniel said softly, no, that was true. Over the next weeks, sightings of Daniel and his truck proved problematic for some. He was accosted by two big white men in a 72 Monte Carlo in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven on Two Notch Road. What you doing with that on your truck, boy? The bigger of the two said. Flying it proudly, Daniel said, noticing the rebel front plate on the Chevrolet. Just like you, brothers. The confused second man took a step toward Daniel. What did you call us? Brothers. The second man pushed Daniel in his chest with two extended fists, but not terribly hard. I don't want any trouble, Daniel told them. And then a Volkswagen with 4 black teenagers parked in the slot beside Daniel's truck, and they jumped out, staring and looking serious. Yo, what's going on? The driver and the largest of the teenagers asked. They were admiring our flag. Daniel said, pointing to his truck. The teenagers were confused. We fly the flag proudly, don't we, young brothers? Daniel gave a bent-arm Black Power closed fist salute. Don't we? He repeated, don't we? Yeah. the young man said. The white man had backed away to their car. They slipped into it and drove away. Daniel looked at the teenagers, and with as serious a face as he could manage, he said, "Get a flag and fly it proudly." At a gas station, a lawyer named Ahmad Wilson stood filling the tank of his BMW and staring at the back window of Daniel's truck. He then looked at Daniel. "Your truck?" he asked. Daniel stopped cleaning the windshield and he nodded. Wilson didn't ask a question, just pointed at the rear window of Daniel's pickup. "Power to the people," Daniel said and laughed. Daniel played Dixie in another bar in town, but this time with the R&B dance band at a banquet of the Black Medical Association. The strange looks and expressions of outrage changed to bemused laughter, and finally to open joking and acceptance as the song was played fast enough for dancing. Then the song was sung slowly, to the profound surprise of those singing the song. "I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away." Soon there were several, then many cars and trucks in Columbia, South Carolina, sporting Confederate flags and being driven by black people. Black businessmen and ministers wore rebel flag buttons on their lapel, clips on their ties. The marching band of South Carolina State College, a predominantly black land-grant institution in Orangeburg, paraded with the flag during homecoming. Black people all over the state flew the Confederate flag. The symbol began to disappear from the fronts of big rigs, in the back windows of jacked-up four-wheelers. And after the emblem was used to dress the yards and mark picnic sites of black family reunions, the following 4th of July, the piece of cloth was quietly dismissed from its station with the U.S. and state flags atop the state capitol. There was no ceremony, no notice. One day, it was not there. Look away, look away, look away.
Reuben Santiago Hudson read Percival Everett's The Appropriation of Cultures. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.